Well, hello everyone. This week and next week, my normal daily videos covering the news and the latest events are going to be suspended for this special new series, which is called Nima Parvini, that's me, versus Right Wing Ideas, where I'm going to interrogate from my value-free, realist lens, lots of right-wing ideas that I think don't get sufficient scrutiny by people who typically count themselves on the right. And also, this series should explain a little bit why I've been calling myself increasingly centre-left. Why am I, you know, a sensible centre-leftist? Why am I increasingly saying this? Well, some reasons are contingent. They're contingent on this moment right now, where rather than adopting the sensible approach that I have advocated for many years now, instead the right, quote unquote, insists on being increasingly slop-brained, vibes-based, populist, falling for any old trick that the Zionists throw in their way. I think that what it has exposed really is that the whole project, the whole right-wing project, doesn't really have sound intellectual underpinnings such as it exists today. And I'm not talking about my ideas necessarily. My ideas have always been framed as being neutral, value-free, elite theory, cyclical history, and so on. These things don't really stand left or right, okay? And as per some of my earlier videos, like my response to Stelios, as an example, I don't think that it's useful to talk about these terms in anything but a current contingency. That is, what is meant by them right now, okay? And what is meant by right now is an increasingly cringe, low IQ, populist, slop-brained, vibes-based movement, which I don't want anything to do with whatsoever. Once upon a time, people read essays and books and theorized. That was a few years ago. Increasingly, it's just me and a couple of other people who do it. Why bother? Why bother? I say, Sodom. I'm going to if all of the people with any amount of intelligence whatsoever sit on the center left, so be it. I'll sit over there as well. The message I've got from the quote unquote right is, well, we just don't want you. We see all that, but actually we want this tasty burger over here being pushed on us by Hasbro agents and the forces of just kind of the most abject stupidity you can imagine. I've made hundreds of videos along these lines. And in this series, I'm going to go through some of those areas of right-wing thought that I think are either, I think the right has no realistic answers to the objections I'm going to put forward, or I think that they haven't even thought it through at all. Okay, so today's topic, and every day I'm going to be picking a topic area. Today's topic is ethnic narcissism. I'm going to be talking about that and the problems with it in a moment. First, though, the autumn sale is still ongoing. Promo code Shredder. I'm going to play the ad, and when I come back, I've actually prepared notes for each of these, so I'm going to have to refer to them. I've got facts, I've got figures, I've got studies. I've been preparing for this for quite a while. And when I come back, I'm going to be talking about ethnic narcissism. There's going to be a new topic every day for the next Monday to Thursday this week, and Monday to Thursday next week. It's going to be an 8-part little mini-series here. And if nothing else, it's a challenge to people out there to come up with any viable counters to the things I'm saying here, okay? I've already said I'm on the centre-left these days. That doesn't mean being pro-immigration, as per Keir Starmer. Being anti-immigration is a proper anti-libertarian left-wing point of view. It doesn't mean being woke. You can be you know, sensible and centered on social issues. Doesn't mean being woke. It does mean being, generally speaking, against untrammeled capitalism and being a kind of economically left, as per some of my recent videos have suggested. Okay, I think this is the sensible position in today's politics. I think that going with the counter-jihad crowd, with the populist crowd, which is a low information, slop-rich zone, frequently riddled with misinformation, downright lies, stupidity. Basically, you're on a hide into nothing. Nigel Farage may win the election, which it looks increasingly likely going to happen. Does that mean you're going to get all your hopes and dreams from Nigel? Well, you can watch my recent appearance on Peter McCormack's show to see what I think about that. Over 50,000 people have watched that. Okay, so pick up a course. And when I come back, I'm going to talk about ethnic narcissism.
It's promo code Shredder. World-class education denied to you by school, denied to you by woke university. Well, no more. Pick up your course today. 25% off all courses with promo code Shredder. That's Shredder. Buy it now.
All right, ethnic narcissism. Where shall I start with this? Well, I mean, typically speaking, the right-wing view is that the white population has been too individualistic and is uniquely kind of out-group preferenced. So there's been a lot of stuff on in-group preference as something desirable or something that, you know, people should do more of. The trouble with this, and it's something I've talked about many times, is that it doesn't outpace the basic problem of competitive meritocracy. This is actually something that is discussed by the elite theorists. It's discussed by Mosca and Pareto at different times, where they talk about the ideal elite being an aristocracy of the talents, as against hereditary systems, as against systems that promote nepotism, as against systems like the Bolsheviks, for example, that demand ideological adherence or you know, loyalty to a belief system. They say that in the long run, those ways of arranging the elites lose out to systems that take in the quote-unquote aristocracy of the talents. And this is something that I've struggled with for many, many years. In fact, I had debates in the past with Mike from Imperium and with Pharaoh and others on this basic problem, because as somebody who's a gamer, as somebody who is into strategy and so on, as somebody who grew up watching football, it's very difficult to get away from this logic. For example, in the Football League, I remember in the 90s, Jimmy Hill arguing long and hard, keep the league English, keep only English players in the league. And he was arguing that unless the Premiership does that, the England national football team won't perform well, because he was thinking, well, you need more players at the top level who are English for the England team to do well. The counter, of course, to Jimmy Hill was that if one team starts recruiting players from all over the world, let's say Arsenal starts recruiting players from all over the world, and Manchester United does not do that, it's only a matter of time before Arsenal starts outcompeting Manchester United. And if all the clubs in the league start doing it, then the one who doesn't is more likely to go down, get relegated, get less money. So there's an inextricable logic that, if you know, it just stands to reason. If you're recruiting players from all around the world, as against just the ones from your own nation, the ones drawn from the smaller talent pool won't be as good as the one drawn from literally the talent pool of the entire world, okay? Now, the same is true in the business world. I'm not talking about, you know, DEI boards and diversity is our strength type stuff. I'm talking about crunch areas where it's actually really important to get people of the requisite ability. A good example I can give you is back when I was working in the city, I used to go to New York and Chicago and elsewhere, Frankfurt, Paris, and all around the world, I'd be seeing these investment banks and these hedge funds and various different specialist trading firms, high-frequency trading firms as they existed back then. Okay, this was a good 15 years back now, 14, 15 years back. And I remember in every single one of the top trading firms, the low-latency trading firms, the hedge funds, the market makers, their quant teams were almost exclusively Chinese. Their fintech team, their engineering teams, tended to be English chaps, but their quant teams were Chinese. And I remember at the time, I was friendly with this professor in Chicago, and I asked him, I said, "Hey, how comes the quant teams are all Chinese?" And he just said, "It's simple. They're really good at maths, and they're the only ones who can do it. If we don't take them, the firm that does take them will outcompete us. And at this level, any little margin, any edge you can get is absolutely important." Same in the football world, of course. Any edge you can get is important. So this is meritocracy in the truest sense, selecting the absolute best in class, wherever they may be, whether it's the Chinese quant or whoever it is, pick your favorite Brazilian footballer here. You can also see it in a micro scale. I've given the example many times in the past of when I played Crusader Kings 2. Now, in Crusader Kings 2, I always, every single time I've played that game, ever since it came out, I start in one Welsh county, Glamorgan, which is where I grew up, right? And I stubbornly, even though I've got all the mods to start anywhere in the world, I start in Glamorgan, okay? So I'm a little Welsh lord, okay, starting off there. Don't ask me why, that's just what I prefer to do, okay? But then, as the game progresses, there are all sorts of decisions you have to make. Okay, especially as you're competing with other local lords, and basically you're looking to expand. Ultimately, you're seeking to start an empire in Crusader Kings 2. And, ultimately, starting from Glamorgan, you want to take Wales, then you want to take England and Scotland, and typically I expand out to Iceland, and I try to take the Nordics, and that's my little kind of empire there. By the time I've done that, usually we're getting towards the end, seldom do I take the whole map, although continental wars do start and so on. Now, in the process of doing that, you've got a little council, okay? And on that council, it's much like the council in Game of Thrones. You've got the Hand of the King, the guy in charge of the treasury, you've got the guy, the marshal guy, the commander of the army, a spy, and various other roles. And of course, they have stats, which are linked to the individual characters. Now, if I was to keep my little Welsh court, the stats that I would have on that court, unless I was extremely lucky, would be mediocre. So typically, my courts, as the game develops, because I'm playing to min-max, I'm playing to win, I'm playing to expand the empire, I'm playing to make sure I've got enough revenue, enough men to win that game, okay? If I'm offered the Jewish chancellor, say, who's got the 20 commerce stat, which gives me additional income, I'll take it. If there's a heathen who's not a Christian who turns up, right, I don't reject him just because he's a heathen, because he happens to have 20 in spycraft or whatever, okay? So my courts end up being a horrible mishmash of random Polish princesses and one-off Jews coming in from the continent, and occasionally even there'll be people from further afield, although due to the realities of that game and the medieval era, it's rare to have somebody from India or something. They're just too far away, although because Spain has got a lot of Arabs in it at this time, it's possible that you'll get the odd Arab or something coming in through Spain, especially if you're looking to manufacture claims in Spain at that time. So to cut a long story short, my council ends up being basically an aristocracy of the talents, and it's not ethnically homogenous at all. If I was to promote ethno-narcissism, even within the game, you'd end up with a mediocre core and possibly even a dysgenic core, especially if the pool is so small that you end up interbreeding. Okay, and this is something that actually it was seen in actual history. If you have a look at the elite class in Europe, it moved around quite a lot. It actually had quite a lot of foreigners in the actual court. Okay. Now, various people, like Richard Hanania, for example, have called this elite human capital. And, Hanania is cringe and he comes up with a lot of bad arguments. But I think one of the reasons that he upsets people as much as he does, especially with this argument, is that as far as I've seen, there's no basic answer to this raw fact. The raw fact being the firm who doesn't do it, the football club, the court that doesn't do this, gets outcompeted by the one who does. Okay. Now, I understand that mass immigration destabilizes the population underneath, okay, the mass underneath. But, as I'll talk about in a couple of subsequent episodes, an ethnically mixed up mass where there's actually simmering tensions underneath, you know, the multicultural scenario, does actually make the mass easier to divide and conquer from the point of view of the elite. So it's actually advantageous to them to manage it in that way, even though it sucks for the peasant on the ground, okay? The justification for that mess underneath is that, and Boris Johnson, when he was the Prime Minister, explicitly talked in these terms. He said, I believe that, he said, talent is distributed equally in populations, okay? So Boris Johnson was actually thinking along the lines of Hanania when he did the Boris wave and so on. And he was thinking, well, from the level of the elite firm, who's picking only the top 2%, top 3%, top 5%, whatever, scrimming off the top, from that point of view, it makes sense from their point of view. What I want to know, or I haven't been able to come up with, is what is the actual ethno-narcissist answer to this? Because this is the actual reason why so many European elites and American elites are addicted to this way of thinking, because it's the true quote-unquote meritocracy. Now, there is also, and I think we're seeing this in America as one kind of older ruling dynasty that grew up after the Second World War, you know, from a certain background, are currently degrading. Nepotism has a habit of degrading elites. Spandrel talked about he talked about bio-Leninism, right? Spandrel talked about bio-Leninism. He also talked about the IQ shredder, which is the flip side of this, where this process I'm talking about actually funnels all of the intelligent people in the world into cities, and then it shreds them with the low birth rate. That'll be a separate video later on. The basic idea of bio-Leninism is that, you know, the Bolsheviks ultimately were selecting not for the best, not for the brightest, not on merit, not on ability, but on ideological adherence and personal loyalty to Lenin. Okay, this is good if you're trying to create a political vanguard, as Lenin was. It's bad if you're trying to win in a competitive system. So it led to bio-Leninism, a degradation of elites in the Soviet Union. Now, I would argue that Barry Weiss, who has recently been appointed as the senior editor of CBS, is a very good example of this elite degradation in actu. You know, once upon a time, American elites of Barry Weiss's persuasion kind of background were people like Walter Lippmann, or they were people like Edward Bernays. Now, you can say what you want about Bernays or Lippmann or any of the people who built Hollywood, but they were talented. They were really good at what they did. They were intelligent. The same could not be said of the current crop, which brings me to another problem, which is something that has been commented on many times, which is that nepotism and ethno-narcissism have a habit of promoting the rule of three, what they call the rule of three generations. It's very difficult and seldom seen in history for any family to have power and success at any kind of high level for more than three or four generations, and it starts degrading. It's the old tale of, you know, you get a great man like Henry Ford, but then his son is a dipshit and his grandson's an even bigger dipshit. And before you know it, the Ford dynasty has been kind of lost to managerial powers. Or even worse, and I pulled up some studies. Let me actually find the study that talks about this, because the figures are quite incredible. I mean, there are so many families who amassed huge fortunes, huge power, hundreds of billions of dollars. The Vanderbilt family, for example, $300 billion equivalent they amassed by 1877. You know, one of the big tycoons. In three generations, they basically squandered the lot. They were going bankrupt. You know, three or four generations, they'd squandered the money, profligate, gambled it away, pissed it up the wall, etc. Another example, the Hartford family, the people who built the A&P grocery chain, you know, huge estate built up, lost in a couple of generations. There's so many. I mean, I won't go through all of them, but there's the Stroh family, the Amor family, the Yeo family in Singapore. Here's what I wanted to get to in this study, which is there was a study done by a group called the Williams Group. They analysed 3,200 affluent families. The number who had lost their wealth by the second generation was 70%. The number that had lost their wealth by the third generation was 90%. This pattern holds across various sources, with only about 10% of families preserving significant wealth beyond three generations. And this is something that in the book The Ruling Class, Giantano Mosca discusses. He says, very few families in history have managed to hold on to wealth for 10 or more generations. To give you an example of the current elite families, the Rothschilds are on generation 8 or 9, okay, right now. But you've heard their name, and this is what Mosca says, is that if you get to 10 or more, this is an achievement recognised by all people everywhere, okay? So you could argue the Rothschild family, if they are still prominent now, and you could debate as to how prominent they are now, okay, they're on generation 8 or 9. But this is absolutely exceptional, and fewer than 1% of all wealthy families, all rich, powerful aristocrats, you name it, ever attain that status, ever. Okay, an NBER working paper on US wealth from 1850 to 1940 tracked elite families, found that 93% of grandchildren of the top 1% wealth holders did not remain in the top 1%. And even those of the ultra wealthy, so if your grandparent was in the ultra wealthy class, that's the 0.1%, that's the Elon Musks of this world today, okay? 86% fell out with rapid downward mobility within a generation or two. 90% of children from upper-class households, measured by live-in servants, did not attain that status as adults. I can keep on going on and on, because this is a very robust field. Of those families that have managed to maintain their status, I mean, the Rockefeller family is still going. The Johnson family in America are fifth generation at the moment. But so you can see that what this tells you is that ethnic narcissism and nepotism are not actually winning. They tend to lose. Now, how do we then try to measure those systems that don't do this, that don't select for, that don't kind of select for in-group, don't do nepotism? And I mean, you can look at, one example would be the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire famously stopped selecting for Roman, didn't select for ethnic Romans. It selected for, the best and the brightest of all of the people from the empire. Anybody could join. That kept on going for 400 years doing that. So, what I'm looking at here, what I'm thinking about is, well, is that the example? Is that the equivalent of the Manchester United who doesn't do it going down? That's all of those wealthy families whose pissed are up the wall by three generations' time, versus something like the Roman Empire, which was, okay, it fell eventually, but it's still, 400 years is a pretty good innings by any stretch of the imagination. Which also then gives some other food for thought. This preference that some on the right have for ethnic narcissism ignores the actual historical reality that elites, not just now, but back in the Roman Empire or many other empires, which I'm also going to talk about in tomorrow's video, tended to be multi-ethnic. They tended to accept people from different backgrounds under the empire into the elite as a ruling strategy of necessity, which helps these things perpetuate themselves and keep going. So, the Roman Empire, 400 years using that particular strategy. And in fact, some of the literature on this compares Chinese Han strategy of in-group preference versus Roman Empire. As one example, so what else do we have here? Because I've taken quite a lot of notes for this first one, but I want to make sure that I don't leave anything out. So they've done quite a lot of studies on what it actually does to an elite network to have this in-group preference, to have this ethnic narcissism. And one recent study from this year shows that it can reduce organizational efficiency by up to 30%. And that huge amount of management time is wasted on any person who's been selected for reasons other than their actual ability. Okay, just because your uncle owned the company, as an example, well, you'll give that guy a job, but the guy is inept, or the guy is lazy, or has the wrong attitude, or he's entitled. So, 30% drop-off in efficiency for the ethno-narcissist company versus the one the hires on merit. That's a pretty big difference. Another study that I saw showed that the drop in institutional performance for a company that promotes through ethnic preference, and again, I think the Barry Weiss CBS example is a good one, shows a 20% drop in institutional performance. Okay, so if you've got a family-run business that's doing nepotism, or one that is selecting, you know, just because, I don't know, let's say it's Indians hiring Indians, or in the case of Barry Weiss, you know, Zionists hiring Zionists, whatever, 20% drop-off in institutional performance. So, yeah, I think the literature, i.e. the actual statistics, the evidence, the outcomes, doesn't matter which field you go to, shows that ethnic narcissism has a habit of losing out against those firms who are doing meritocracy properly. Okay. I think I'll leave it there because I've been talking for half an hour now. But this is an issue for anyone who would prefer a system where somebody is hired or not hired based on background, based on, you know, let's just pretend you're one of those people who wants to see, like, a, you know, a white-only Britain, something like that. What happens if you do that and then, as against France, Germany, Poland, Russia, you know, who aren't doing this, you then end up getting outcompeted on a national level in the same way Manchester United would get relegated, or in the same way that the hedge fund that doesn't hire the quants, you know, goes out of business, and the one that do have that competitive edge. I don't know the answer to that question. Now, one classic answer would be, well, the thing is, if you have multiculturalism, that has a habit of splitting up social cohesion, splitting up kind of moral unity, and ultimately it's going to lead to collapse. Ultimately, it's going to lead to the thing imploding in on itself, because, you know, people haven't got anything left to fight for, blah, 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 blah. And also that, you know, if you had a group of, let's say, high IQ Anglos who could, like, do it all themselves, you know, look at Britain back when it, you know, back when it was a British Empire, for example, that was mostly ethnic Brits doing it for themselves type thing. That's the kind of big counter argument. The trouble is with that is if you try it, let's pretend you try it, and it does actually result in what I've been saying, that, you know, Manchester United getting relegated and Arsenal winning the league, in that example, or the competing countries who are pursuing a different strategy outcompeting you, the net result will be that eventually those other countries, just by being more richer and more powerful, in the long enough run, will take over. And you could argue that is actually what America did to Europe. You could, and we're gonna come to some other difficult ideas in the next couple of days. We're gonna talk about racial superiority as an idea tomorrow, and we're going to talk about nationalism as an idea in 2 days' time. But this basic problem that I'm talking about here, where the big multi-ethnic power, whether it's the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, the British Empire, or now the American Empire, has a habit of then taking over any little place that is trying to pursue ethnic narcissism on its own. So that would be the real, like, if we're going to take ethno-nationalism seriously as an idea, what would actually happen if you have this kind of, like, you're basically nerfing the stats due to the smaller talent pool, and you're arguing that through something like Asabaya, which is a concept I talk about in Prophets of Doom, you're going to outcompete other countries who aren't pursuing, you know, who are still going with the old way. I don't know. It's a big risk. It's a big risk, and history has a habit of showing that the empires that pursue the strategy I'm talking about generally tend to win out. Now, they do come to a point of collapse, okay? But collapse can take a very long time. 400 years in the case of the Roman Empire. In the meantime, they had a lot of victories, okay? And all the other empires too. So only at the very bitter end do they fall apart. And you could even argue, as I will get onto, that notions of superiority that start to creep in after success can actually be the breeding grounds of then losing to some lesser group. For example, when the Arabs carved through the Middle East, they were up against people who were more civilized, who considered themselves superior to other people. They were a low IQ group, okay? Or you can have a look at the Mongols when they sliced through millions of miles of Asia and Eastern Europe. Can't remember how far they got. But it was the same thing. You know, you'd say, well, who were the superior IQ group? In so many cases, it's not the group that ends up winning. That group that ends up winning just had superior asabaya up against people who just considered themselves better, innately superior in some way, even though they had better tech and better equipment and better tactics and so on, they ended up losing out. So all of those things I'll get to in future videos. For today, I've talked about ethnic narcissism. I've given lots of people things to think about. I'd love to see some of the comebacks on this, some of the anything I've missed, some of the principal objections, examples of cases where the opposite has happened, where somebody's tried this and it's won out. I'd love to see it. All right, pick up a course at the academic agency, and I'll see you tomorrow for more Nima Parvini versus right-wing ideas.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.